This is Smeagol. When I'm not trying to protect my precious from wicked, tricksy hobbitses, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. They talk about many things that you filthy fanboys will love to listen to. And while you're listening, make sure you follow them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and any social media on which you can find them. What is Twitter? Is it a bird? Is it tasty? Can I eat it? I can't eat Twitter. Smeagol is so sad. Smeagol wants to eat Twitter. Well, if I can't eat Twitter, I'll go listen to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. It will make Smeagol happy again. Happy, happy, happy! Just make sure you don't touch my precious while I'm listening.
Fanboy.com.
Thank you for joining me. Should we just begin this conversation?
I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
All right, ready to go. So, well, let's just start off by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I am on the line with two talented creators by the names of Matthew Sumo and Pete Collins. And I always like to, you know, whenever we have a Kickstarter crew, I like to get started off right off the bat and say that they are on the line because they have a Kickstarter going, and it is for a title called The Bardic Verses, correct?
Correct.
Nailed it. All right, great. We are on the run. We are ready to go. I should also thank, I believe it's Jeff Haas, who got us into touch with each other. It's weird because usually I deal with creators one-on-one, but lately a couple of PR people have contacted me and been like, hey, do you want to meet with these guys? And I'm like, sure. And usually I just, you know, get people one-on-one. But so it's, we've been bouncing a little bit back and forth. I didn't realize that your Kickstarter was sort of like kind of towards the tail end at this point. Like we're midway through, correct?
Yeah, I think we're a little over midway through at this point. We have 13 days to go.
Yeah, I just looked at it and it's something like 12. So I'm going to try and have this up earlier rather than later for you.
Awesome.
So that you can get more money. But it looks like you just funded, so that's great.
Yeah, we're in stretch goal mode now. We're trying to push to see if we can get ourselves to a hardcover.
That's great. Oh, a hardcover. Nice. Fancy. Well done.
Yeah.
So for people that do not know, and I myself am a little ignorant as to what the Bardic Verses is. I did check out your website and I looked at the Kickstarter. It looks like I have a couple of role-playing game fans on the line. Is that correct? Nice.
Yeah, Pete's more of the role playing fan, the tabletop role playing game fan.
Uh-huh.
More of the video game role playing game fan, but I think, you know, we brought a little bit of both to the book for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. And it's according to the, so it's interesting. I'm assuming that Dungeons and Dragons was like a big thing because it's a bard, right?
Yeah. So Matt and I were kind of talking about we were in the early talkings of like, you know, getting a story together, working on a project, looking for something to do, mm-hmm. Together. And, it was around the time that The Witcher came out. And of course that has, a bard character in there who, may be a little underutilized.
Okay.
But certainly has catchy songs. I still have that Toss a Coin to Your Witcher song stuck in the back of my head to this day. And then we just started talking about, like, you know, my time playing Dungeons and Dragons. You know, I've played a bard. I've been in groups with people playing bards and how that is generally an underappreciated archetype across the, you know, all of the vast fantasy stories that are out there. And that's kind of where we just started to, you know, it was like Inception. We just started to roll with it, you know,
going down the hidey hole. No, yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, I've talked about it on this podcast before. I mean, I was definitely into Dungeons and Dragons when I was younger. And as I got older, and I still kind of, up until the pandemic started, was meeting with friends like once every couple of months to run a superhero role playing game. But I hadn't touched like Dungeons and Dragons in forever. And I don't recall, like, I'm talking like I used to play in the 80s, late 80s and stuff like that. I'm old, people. I'm old. And so I don't recall the bard being like a thing in the early D&D games. But am I wrong about that? Or,
well, I think the bard came in, I think, with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which became second edition.
Sure.
It was part of the core books.
Okay.
And from there, in second edition, playing a bard is literally like the worst statistical class you can play. they don't get additional attacks. They have like some minor magical feats, but they're not throwing fireballs. The entire purpose of that character essentially is support. You are solely around to boost morale and by default boost the statistics of the other players.
Sure.
And from the, you know, statistics aside and special perks and abilities aside, the person that's playing the bard has to, you know, they have to be vocal. They have to be charismatic. They have to be flamboyant in a sense, and they have to kind of, it kind of serves a dual purpose almost to that extent, because the character is boosting the morale of his party, but the player is potentially boosting the morale of the players around him. So it's an interesting dynamic, but the character itself, you know, you're not the cool guy in the group. You're never the cool guy in the group as the bard.
Yeah. Maybe that's why or in the games that I played, no one ever played a bard, because it's like, Who wants to be the support animal of the group?
Yeah, they got a lot better with it. You know, in different editions. Now they're in their fifth edition, and I've been dabbling with that a little bit recently. Mm-hmm. And they certainly care a lot more about the class now.
Oh,
but you said you were playing a superhero game. Though?
Yeah. I know we play an advanced, not an advanced version, a modified version of this game called Villains of Vigilantes, which was one of sort of like the early superhero games in the 80s. And it's just a system that, you know, I knew as a kid and we played a lot. And, you know, I would switch around between like Champions and Dungeons and Dragons. And there was like stuff like Gamma World and Star Frontiers and Top Secret.
Oh, wow.
Like these are all 80s. Like, you know, we were nuts about it. And I'm kind of a, what's that?
You're saying names I haven't heard in years.
Yeah, well, look it up, buddy. No, I mean, they were fun games, and I still am like a collector, like a hoarder, and obviously I run a podcast, you know, that's about comics and stuff like that. So I did go through a period when I was a teenager where we all were going through a period where it was like anytime like a new game came out, you know, we would go nuts about it, but, and just try and play that. And especially when you just had tons of time to just read rules and learn rules and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And back in like the 80s and early 90s, TSR advertisements were prevalent in the back of specifically Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's like you'd hear about Dark Sun, the new dark apocalyptic Dungeons and Dragons setting. Oh, okay. That sounds pretty cool. It's in the back of an issue of Spider-Man.
Yeah, right,
cool.
For sure. I mean, there definitely was a period where like they were being somebody at Marvel realized, or whatever advertising realized, that, you know, nerds were into role playing games too, besides, you know, what was happening with Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four or Superman at DC. But yeah, no. So I'm interested about the Bard because I have actually not had a chance to check out Witcher yet, which is, I know it's a mortal sin amongst nerds and RPG people. But so tell me, I mean, because you're saying that the bard has to be charismatic. So is that a character that you, like, as you started discovering Dungeons and Dragons, you were just like, hey, this guy, or was it Witcher that sort of turned you on to that? Like, which came first? Was it the RPG class or the show Witcher that kind of was like, hey, what's that? Is that a bard? Why, he's pretty cool.
Well, I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons since 1992.
Sure.
So, you know, and I'd certainly played a couple of bards before then. When Matt and I started talking, you know, the initial point of where a bard as a whole, as a thing, kind of came into our conversation was based around The Witcher, though.
Got you.
I enjoyed the show. I've read the first book, but I love the game series, which is a totally different animal from the book. But so, you know, it's interesting to see, like, that character in that show is not that character from the video game.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting.
They're very different.
Oh, no, but let's talk about the bardic verses, because so let me get this straight. So Matt, can I say Matt or Matthew?
Matt's fine.
Yeah, because my name's Christian, but I hate being called Chris. But, you know, okay. So Matt's good. I don't want to step on anyone's toes. So let's talk about the comic book. Like, I mean, who is the writer? Are you both writing it? Is one the writer, one the artist? Because I'm a little ignorant as to who's doing what on this book. Matthew, are you the writer? Pete, are you the writer? Okay, Matthew's the writer.
Yes.
Gotcha. And so you not being into RPG stuff or stuff like that, or as into tabletop stuff as Pete is, if you were watching The Witcher, how much background research did Pete have to give you as far as, like, a character like that?
He gave me, like, little bits and bobs here and there, but I think, you know, mostly how we utilized the bard character was, again, more so as another way to tell an underdog story, because that's what that character is, right? Like, he's, you know, the guy who's not doing the cool stuff. So we, you know, it was a little bit of that. And also it was a lot of using the fact that he like tells stories and plays songs as sort of like the framing device for the book. So the way the book starts is he's in a tavern playing, he's playing a set list, and that set list are the stories in the book. And to illustrate the different styles of music, he used different styles of art. And those different styles of art are homages to different artists that we both appreciate, I guess.
Yeah, I noticed a Jack Kirby looking sort of thing in there. I get it now. Oh, okay. And this is like an anthology book, correct?
It is and it isn't. So it is in the fact that, like, it is there are different stories. They kind of stand alone, but we, as we discover, they do kind of connect. Like, it is one long journey where he goes on different adventures, and we figure out, like, that he's actually at that tavern that he starts the book in for a reason, and we find that out during the course of the story, and then we find out what he needs to do at the end, and that's kind of where we wrap the book up. So it is an anthology where, like, it is those standalone stories, or those stories that could stand alone. They're all done in different art styles, but it's not. It is actually one complete story as well.
Oh, gotcha. So am I correct in thinking they are different stories, but there's like an interconnected sort of theme or vibe or something through the whole book?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Nice. That's smart. And so when you are creating a book about a bard who I'm assuming is wandering the land, having adventures, kind of like Pulp Fiction, like what's his name? I'm going to walk the earth. He's walking the earth. Is it Jules, the character that I'm thinking?
Jules.
Yeah, Jules. Yeah. So he's walking the earth and he's telling tales. How does your world building go? I mean, obviously you have some things that inspire you, like role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons, The Witcher show, but how did you come about, like, crafting the universe that this character exists in, because you can't just like rip off like other things, right? I mean, you can, but you don't want to do that and get sued. How did the world building go between the two of you?
Good question. So each of the stories starts, or they take place, I should say, in a different location. So gotcha. at the very beginning of the book, he's come into town. He seats himself into a tavern, and that's where he begins his set. As he sings his set, and we get into those individualized stories. Each story takes place in a different location, and so it's like we're there's name dropping. The visuals in the backdrop change. We get into some of the characters and where they are. Some of those characters he crosses paths with at different points again in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely a greater sense of, you know, different places, but not necessarily too close or too far, right? And okay. One of the things that that I found interesting as I was drawing this is, like, you know, we've got a forest. There are some elves in that forest. That particular story has like a Disney-like vibe to it. So. Mm. You know, that's the art style. So there's another forest later on at a different point in the story where it is absolutely not a Disney style. And so, like, you know, having to draw the forest in a completely different way, you know, so it's that part of it's been interesting to kind of visualize what does the background look like and how does it play out. We actually do have in the back matter of our book a map that we're including as well. So you can see the entire area. It'll have a pathway so you can kind of follow his trail along the stories. So it'll help visualize things a little bit, you know, to the reader.
Gotcha. And so you're drawing this whole thing by like on your own, or is it different artists doing different chapters?
100% me.
Oh, wow.
I'm doing the drawing and the coloring.
So how are you finding it a challenge to adapt to all those styles? And were you the one, or was Matt the one who was like, okay, this one's going to be like Disney. Oh, maybe this one's going to be like Jack Kirby. Oh, this one's going to be, you know, and if Matt was the one, were you cursing him on each different time that he came to you with like a different world and be like, damn it, now I have to do this?
Well, the idea in general to kind of inflex in different art styles was definitely Matt's idea.
Okay.
And then
sure, I think it's Matt's idea. Let Matt come up with the hard stuff.
And then as far as what approaches we took, you know, he had a couple, I had a couple. I think we've been in constant communication throughout all of this, so it's been very much a back and forth effort, just to, you know. You know, if I draw half a panel and I like the way it looks, I'll snapshot it and send it to him.
Sure.
You know, we're picking each other's brains constantly about stuff. So, I do think there was a couple of different things we wanted to try in the book that, ultimately we ended up shifting directions, you know, just through organic discussion,
mm-hmm.
And not really for like any particular reasons.
Gotcha.
You know, or any differences at all. It was just like, hey, this is a cool idea. And then it was like, all right, maybe we're running out of some space here. Let's do this instead. You know, there is, I think there's one section in the book. I know that Matt, really did want to do. And that's the Frank Miller.
Oh, nice.
Portion of our book. Which, you know, plays very much off the black and white style of Sin City.
Nice.
So, and that portion of the book is called The Maiden to Smite For. And
nice.
There's a town that's called Leaf Field in it.
Oh, wow.
Which most of the entire book is an homage to fantasy and role playing, the Dungeons and Dragons experience, if you will. To individual artists, in some cases it's maybe more of a parody than a true homage, and then of course just to the anthology concept itself. So
sure,
it is an homage to homages.
Sure. Well, how hard is it for either of you? I mean, you know, Pete, as an artist, it must be hard to be like, okay, now I'm going to do an homage to Frank Miller. I'm going to do an homage to, you know, Jack Kirby. Maybe not so much with Liefeld, but sorry, I had to get it in there. I apologize to Rob Liefeld. And Matt, for you as a writer, I'm assuming that with those artist styles, you're sort of shifting gears, like tone, correct? As to sort of match those kinds of comics, right?
Yes. So I would say for some of it, yes. I think the two biggest ones that I had to do that for were the Frank Miller piece, because I had to go real like caption heavy. So like you get a lot of our main characters in her monologue. And then for I forget what we nicknamed it. Wonderville, we nicknamed it. That's the Disney story.
Gotcha.
That one, it's actually the full title is Fear and Loathing in Wonderville. that one I had to channel a little bit of Disney because there was a straight up musical number.
Oh, wow.
In the middle of it. Yeah. So I had to like actually write song lyrics, and that was annoying. Ultimately fun. Like I think Pete did a really good job at like animating that. And then that honestly, like that story has probably one of our biggest, it's like the turning point of the book. Like that's where we kind of really figure out like what the rest of the book is going to look like, or what where he's going, you know, on the rest of his journey. Uh-huh. So it's like, it's super fun, super ridiculous, but also super important, which Pete found a really good balance of like illustrating all of that. Like he definitely, there's one page in particular that like, I don't want to spoil it, but I will say like, I had emotions looking at that page. It's super good. And again, like just such an important piece for the book and for something that like kind of starts out super silly.
That's awesome. So for the Frank Miller one, was it like, my beer, it sits on the counter. I see her. I lust after her. Was it that sort of thing? Today would be a good way to die.
It's not as intense. Frank gets really intense in his caption,
sure,
but it is a lot. It's a whole lot of like inner monologue. Like he's talking about like how he's like how he should have brought the banana. Like he's super hungry. Like what's this guy's deal over
my
here?
Banana?
Like, I'm
super hungry. Yeah, I feel it like, in the depths of my soul. Yeah,
it's just like it's that inner monologue, but it's more in line with the character where it's like more silly than it is like
sure
super serious and sure. And
well, there is a dramatic thing with like Frank Miller dialogue where you can, people who try to ape it a lot, if you go too far, it could be exactly what I was doing, which is like it almost dissolves into parody, right?
Yeah.
How about you, Pete, as far as like the art style goes, like shifting gears and stuff like that? I mean, I did ask you a little bit about it earlier, but it's got to be a challenge to jump between like Frank Miller and then, you know, animating sort of, you know, animation style and musical numbers, correct?
Oh, it absolutely is. So I made one strategical mistake when we first started this, and that was I decided it would be in my best interest to do the pages sequentially. So I started at page one and started working my way through. And it worked. It worked. It was challenging, you know, definitely challenging. But by the time I had hit, like, you know, page 40 or so in the book, I started to look back at my own stuff because I'm bouncing in and out. I'm doing 5 pages in my style, 7 pages in this style, 2 pages in my style, 8 pages in this style. And every time I went back to my own style, I had picked up things that I learned from trying to emulate Rob Liefeld. It sounds bad. It's actually, there's a couple of good things in there. I
sure.
Promise. And, but you know, you pick up the good and the bad. And it was, so then I had to like, at one point, this was actually a couple months ago, I just said, hey, I'm going to go back and redo the first 3 pages because the first three pages didn't look anything like what I was doing with my own style currently. So just to make sure that it all blended well and it didn't like throw off readers, I went back and I redid them. So it's definitely challenging. You know, some of them are more of a fun challenge, like the Kirby stuff. The Kirby stuff was fantastic. Like I kind of went into it a little intimidated, and that was the first one I did. And, you know, Kirby's very distinct, you know, his lines go from thick to thin like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a reason why there's not a lot of people out there doing exactly his style.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I agree with the cat. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. She gets super needy when I'm on podcast for some reason.
That's totally cool. No, we've had dogs bark. We've had, you know, interesting things happen. It's not a big deal. I agree with her. She's totally right. No, it's funny because like, yeah, Kirby is very distinct and very powerful and stuff. But there's another artist who is influenced by him named Steve Rood, who I'm a huge fan of. Right.
Oh yeah.
And his stuff just flows like, whereas I see Kirby as like, very like, you know what I mean? Like just like, and powerful and jumping between panel and panel and very impactful. Like Steve Rood, there is something that flows in between panels and is very sort of,
soft.
Yeah. Soft and, almost like a ballet to me. But you can still see that hardcore like Kirby influence in his work.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. I think where Rood kind of takes a left-hand turn is that, he embraces the finer lines a lot more than Kirby did.
Yeah.
You know, Kirby was all about bold lines, bold shapes, and experimenting with, not so much textures, patterns.
Yeah.
You know, you always had like those zigzag like designs on characters' costumes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. You look at anything from the New Gods.
Yeah. Right?
Except for maybe Darkseid, I guess. But you know, consider Orion's costume. There's some crazy shapes on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Miracle. Crazy shapes on that.
Yeah. No, it's funny that you mentioned that because I actually just got the John Byrne like New Gods omnibus that came out recently. Oh. And I was looking through it and just looking at John Byrne drawing those costumes. And then you mentioned Darkseid, and I'm like, Darkseid is the most boring, like visually, like except for his face, like everything else about him is just not like, I'm just like, wow, compared to everyone else's outfits, like Darkseid is just, he's like, I'm not having it. It's just, I'm not having any crazy lines or funky designs on my outfit. It's just, it's very, which is probably very much the point, is that he is sort of like the negativity in the universe and is not, you know, to be like big and colorful. But that's really great. So like when you are, how did both of you meet? I mean, I guess I didn't even get to that. Like how do you live in the same town? Are you in the same area? Or cause I mean, we're speaking through the magic of Skype. This podcast is not sponsored by Skype in any way. I'm just saying like, I'm assuming that you're both are in the same time zone because we, you know, we lined up times. So are you in the same city area or?
So we have the same employer for our day job. We don't live in the same area anymore because of COVID.
Gotcha.
We did share the same state at one point because that's where our day job is located.
Nice.
But basically the meet cute, I guess, of it all is he used to work in the building that I used to work at. He works in a different building now. When I started with the company, like, and he had already moved on to the other building, I would see drawings that he handed out to people. Like,
oh,
he,
cool.
There's a, I specifically remember one of our coworkers has a drawing of Batman on their desk. And I'm like, instantly, I saw that. I was like, who drew that? Do they still work here? What is their name? Like, give me all the information. And then at the same time, he was hearing about me. He's like, oh, you know, people were telling him, oh, you should talk to Matt. Like, he's written comics. You guys are probably really hit it off. You probably have a lot in common. Fast forward to the company Christmas party. and him and I meet in person, and we were, you know, we just got to chatting. I was working on an anthology at the time called Kayfabe. This was the third volume. And I was like, hey, man, like, I know you draw. I know you, like, want to do more drawings. Like, would you want to do a pinup for this? I'm sure I could talk to them. I'm sure they'll squeeze you in there, no problem. Mm-hmm. And he did. And, I, you know, as they say, the rest is history. We were talking. We've been talking, I guess, I would say probably every day, almost every day since then. And just, you know, workshopping things. And then once we started really rolling with the idea of Bardic Verses, it was, we were like off to the races. I wrote like the first five pages, it was all systems go after that.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know if you've actually, Christian, I don't know if you've seen the movie Love Actually, but this is actually part of the director's cut.
This is the director's cut. I actually love Love Actually. I'm one of those people that I actually very obnoxiously, because to go against the haters every Christmas, I will, in all caps on my personal Facebook page, put like, it's time, and the picture of Love Actually. And people are like, you know, my friends who are like, how could you like that movie? It's a I'm like, I don't care what you say. I like it. I don't know. Which is funny, because the very first time I saw it, I hated it. I hated that movie with a passion. And then something happened like a couple years later, I watched it again and I was like, what was wrong with me? But anyway, enough about Love Actually. So since you brought up Love Actually, are there any romantic tales in the Bardic Verses? Is it all action, or is there romance, or is this, I'm assuming it's a chance to tell all different kinds of tales, right? Like that sort of thing.
Yeah. So it is a chance to tell all different kinds of tales, but there is like a little underlying romance. I will say my favorite sequence in the book takes place again in A Maiden to Smite For, because as Pete said, that was my favorite story to write. We do have a tango scene.
Oh,
that,
nice.
Because again, there is some action that happens, there is some fighting, but our character Martone does not take part in it because he's a bard, as they all call him. He's just a bard. So he has to kind of get into action in a different way. So he decides to tango with an old flame of his, and you know, we kind of revisit their brief romance, and then she may or may not show up later on in the book.
Gotcha. So I'm assuming that there's a lot of different creatures, monsters, like that sort of thing. How did that all develop? Like, were you, I'm assuming that there was a lot, there's obviously a lot to be inspired by, but is there a big bad as these all tie together? Is it that sort of thing? Did you have trouble coming up with creatures of your own, designing creatures of your own? How did that work out for the both of you?
Well, there's not too many creatures in the book per se. There's a couple for sure. You know, we wanted to keep it humble, because this is a lower scale story. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't want to drop a dragon into there where it's like, okay, well, here's a story about a bard who's not the hero of his own story, but there's a dragon, you know? So, that may potentially be something that gets worked up to. But there is definitely creatures of mythical proportion, right? There's a couple in there.
I see some goblins on the Kickstarter page.
So oh yes, you do. That's that is Gary. Gary is a side character in this that was just supposed to hang around for a little bit, but Matt and I loved him so much, we used him a little bit here and a little bit there.
Sure. Well, talk to me a little more about, because, you know, I mean, again, we were talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and everyone wants to be the fighter. Everyone wants to be the thief. Everyone wants to be, you know, that sort of thing. Talk to me about writing, creating, drawing for a character that isn't necessarily, you know, like the alpha male, like the one that's going to step into the fray. And like you said, like, he's not going to use his lute or his guitar, you know, to start. He's there to tell the tale or to assist other characters. How does that work for you? Because I mean, you know, a lot of times you know, you just want to be the, people think the fighter is the most interesting character of the group, or the most aggressive character, I should say, is the most interesting character to write for. Mm-hmm. How did that work for both of you?
So on the writing side, for me, again, like, I can't stress this enough. Like, it was another, it's a way for me to tell, like, this truly underdog story, right? Like, he, not only is he a bard, but he's the son of a famous warrior, like his, and he comes from a long line of warriors. All the patriarchs in his family were famous warriors. They all died heroes. And he didn't, like, he chose to pick up a lute instead of a sword.
That's great.
And he really, like, part of the book is him, like, really dealing with not being a warrior, and people, like, his father was so famous that people, like, recognize him and go, hey, aren't you the son of Seeror Swordhand? You know, why are you carrying around a lute and not a sword?
Sure.
And they kind of give him hell for that. And again, people, like, he goes on adventures with groups, and people refer to him as Bard and not by his name. So again, like, for me, it was just a way of telling a story where this guy is, like, literally trying to strike out on his own and be his own person and not follow in his family's footsteps. With that, you know, and he's carrying around that baggage of that famous family.
Artistically too, to kind of mirror off of that, when I draw Martel, you know, panel to panel, I always try to make sure that his facial expression isn't something that's generic.
Sure.
You know, I always try to make him look either confused, deep in thought, concerned, whimsical, scared. You know, like, I shimmy around the emotions a little bit, just because the last thing I want is to have him look like a badass.
Sure.
And the last thing I want is for him to come across as too serious, because that also implies that maybe he has some stock in himself, and there's something more to him than just being, you know, a free music playing traveler. Right. So another thing that I try to do artistically is in the background, I try to make sure that there's always something in the background on every panel, mm-hmm. you know, unnecessarily at times, like whether it's the innkeeper, you know, the tavern keeper trying to kill a moth with a machete or a hatchet, or, you know, an elven woman throwing a lemon across the bar, like just random stuff.
Sure.
But those random things have little payoffs. You know, I try to make the background tell a little bit of a story, and I try to make those characters to a degree look more capable than Martilde, right? Mm. Like, they look like they could handle their own. When you think about Dungeons and Dragons and the classes they're in, you know, if there's a group of people there, I want to make sure that, okay, a third of them are like your warrior archetypes. They have to be bigger than him.
Sure.
I want to make sure that if there's somebody that has kind of like wizardly robes, that they're vibrant and flashy, so that everybody that he's performing for, by and large, looks more important than him.
Sure.
But I also tweak the colors to make sure that he's absolutely in a spotlight.
Sure, sure. So talk to me a little bit, and I kind of want to go back to a little thing that you talked about before. So, Pete, what were you, just walking around the office and drawing Batman pictures for, like, random people? like, were you just like here's Superman, here's Batman? Or were you, like, taking requests at the office? Or was that, like, your thing?
sometimes. I actually, as far as, like, my day job goes, I find myself in a lot of meetings. And sometimes just to get the rage out, or rage is the appropriate thing. We'll stick with rage.
Let's not let the day job know that there's a lot of rage going on.
I hope they're listening.
I'm pretty sure they know.
Okay.
Yeah, they get it. They understand. You know, I'll do like kind of like nervous line sketching just to kind of you know, get it out helps me listen better and retain sometimes.
Yeah.
But also
that's so funny because I do the same thing in meetings, or I used to do when we were in the office, you know, before the pandemic. And it's so funny how people think that you're not paying attention, but it's like, no, this helps me focus because what's happening right now is super boring. And if I don't do this, I will not pay attention. I'll probably fall asleep. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and honestly, you hit the nail on the head. I put things to memory.
Yeah.
Because I'm scratching away on a piece of paper, right?
Yeah.
And where we work, you know, they do several charitable events a year. You know, I always try to donate portraits and that sort of thing, raise money for different causes that our company supports. So you know, I'm always drawing.
Yeah.
You know, one way or the other.
Nice.
So I try to hand it out.
Nice. No, that's good of you. I'm greedy. I keep them to myself. I'm like, no, my precious, you can't have my precious. Yeah. I'm like, no, that's great. That's really cool. And that's great that Matt saw that and came along, and was just like, who's this dude? I want to know who this dude is. Is like your calling card. But I mean, as an artist drawing a character, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's action. I'm sure there's fun and like daring do and stuff like that. But, you know, again, when the character is a little less, like into the fray on their own, did you find it a challenge to sort of portray that, you know?
Oh, yeah. So typically my art lends me down kind of like a gritty style.
Sure. Right?
Where I'm kind of harnessing like the, you know, classic runs of Daredevil and Punisher. I like, you know, I like people, you know, like to draw like, you know, just gritty, nasty,
swole dudes, swole dudes.
Scenes. Yeah. Swole, yeah. If they don't have 5 o'clock shadow, you question what they're doing in the book in the first place. Gotcha. Right? And it's, so like that's where I tend to go. With this book, I transitioned from traditional to digital.
Oh, okay.
Almost fully. I had been doing it for about a year prior. But I made the active decision to do digital in this, for two reasons. One, ease. I can take my tablet places with me. I couldn't carry a stack of paper.
Yeah.
And it permits me the ability to, during the course of the day, if I have 15 minutes here or there, I can scribble something out on my tablet and I don't got to bust out paper and ink and set up an easel and all that.
Of course.
And then the other element of that is I really wanted to experiment with color.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, before this, my art has been black and white.
Gotcha.
I love ink. And I decided I really wanted to play with color.
Nice. And so, what software did you end up using to do your digital?
It's evolved. It's evolved. So at the very beginning of this, I was on an iPad Air with a $5 stylus, although admittedly, I think I used my fingertip more than the stylus.
Oh, wow.
And I was using a lower grade program called Art Studio, which isn't horrible at all. It's just, you know, lower grade.
Yeah.
And then I reached a point where it's like, okay, I need to step up my game. I sucked it up, bought the iPad Pro 12.9. I got the pencil.
Gotcha.
Which I'm on, I think, the current version of that.
Oh, cool.
I stepped into Procreate, which it has been fantastic.
Yeah. People love it. Yeah. A lot of people.
Oh, yeah. It's so great. And I love the video element of it too. So it's like you have it recording in the background. So you can see like, how did I do that? you could almost study yourself.
Yeah. That's cool. Great. That's great. So when you guys both come up with this idea and it's like a bard and you're both like getting jazzed, right, to do this book, Matt, how does the idea process work? Like, Matt, since you're the writer and Pete is the artist, Pete, are you just trusting Matt to come up with the stories, or are you both coming up with like the framework together? And are you both saying like, there's going to be 4 stories, there's going to be 5 stories, it's going to be in this, you know, how did that work out between you two? Whoever wants to take it.
I think it was, you know, it again, like, it was very collaborative. I think there was certain, you know, for the most part, I had kind of the reins on the story, but I always like ran stuff past Pete first.
Before. Okay.
Like, I would say, hey, I think like I'm going to do this. What do you think? And then, you know, we would go back and forth. and similarly, like, I would send him a script and he would go, hey, like, can we trim this, or can I expand on this? And I'm like, yeah, like, I'll just write, if I need to write around it, I'll write around it. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
So again, it was like super, everything was very loose. We kind of, the story really evolved, like, as we were going. Like, I don't think it initially wasn't going to end the way it was going to end. But just from like us spitballing back and forth, I think we really just, you know, reached a point where we're like, all right, like, this is the natural flow to this. But I know for sure, like, we kind of had a list of things that we wanted to pay homage to. And I think we may have cut like one or two things off of that list, but that the list that the stories that are in the book, were like always a part of the list. I don't know if we added anything necessarily, but yeah, it was just, again, a lot of back and forth, a lot of collaboration.
Oh, well, that's
this whole book. Yeah.
So Pete, you were kind of drawing things that you wanted to draw as well, like, did, or was it like
Matt definitely offers direction, right? Where you know, as he's writing the scripts, he's saying, you know, how he visualizes it, how many panels, right? Like, his script is laying things out per panel for me.
Mm.
And which is very helpful. But his directions are guidelines, right? Like, they're very loose.
Okay.
And he gives me that creative freedom to just kind of do what I want. The beautiful thing about that, though, is that the way Matt writes, he has a strong focus on dialogue. The dialogue to him is very important. And when I get the script, I read through it a couple of times just to familiarize, so that it's, you know, ingrained in me as I'm starting to draw. And then I take the individual pages and I keep it on my tablet, and I'm essentially drawing all the pages that you see. I have drawn over his script for that page.
Oh, interesting.
So it's persistently in front of me as I'm drawing. I can't escape
smart.
It. I see what it's saying. And so during the course of that, I find myself reading the dialogue over and over and over and over and over. And it's like, it just paints a lucid picture for me. Right. We defined how Martin looked pretty early on, and some of the other characters. So it was just like, you know, just visualizing in my head, like, okay, this is the tavern. His back's here. There's probably people in the background. What do they look like? They look like this. Got to remember that. Carry to the next page. You know, just, it's a lot of, it's very cerebral, but it's entirely based around just the dialogue.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't find having that script in front of you all the time, like, constraining at all either? Like it doesn't make you feel like, I got to do this. You know what I mean? Or you feel it more frees you up?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't feel constraints at all. I feel that it's there for assurance, right?
Gotcha.
Like I know I'm not going to go off the beaten path, and like, you know, panel three is calling for, you know, him and another guy to talk, but I decided to go left field and do something else. Like, it's assuring.
Sure.
It's very reassuring.
So Matt, would you say that your scripts for this might be more like, you know, there used to be like Marvel style and DC style, and is it sort of like loose panel descriptions and dialogue and that sort of thing, and kind of like have fun with it? Or is it a bit more specific than that?
It's definitely loose descriptions and
cool.
More dialogue heavy. That's just how I've written scripts, like, since the jump. I've been in and out of comics now for about 12 years. So I really haven't changed. But I think for Pete, cause again, like, we were friends first. I tended to be a lot more loose with my panel descriptions, where there were times in the script, I'd be like, hey, like, just go nuts on this. Like, you know, like, just in the interest of saving time and
sure.
not having to like type out an entire description for a scene. And again, there were times where I would write one thing and he would go, hey, like, what if we did this? And there's another scene in the book, which I think art wise is Pete's best work that he's ever done. And it's something that we're keeping very close to the chest, cause we want people to see it when the book comes out.
Sure.
It's, like, I didn't write it this way. He kind of, like, when he got up to it, he's like, oh, what if we do this? And then we were kind of going back and forth, and it's tremendous. Like, it's a 2-page spread. Like, we showed it, we're in a group chat with a bunch of other creators, and we showed it there, and people were like, this is incredible. Like, what a piece. Like, we almost want to, I think when we start doing shows, we're going to make a print of it, and sell it at shows, because it's so good. Like, it's awesome. Just, it's like the pinnacle of like art and storytelling in 2 pages. It's so good.
You're selling it up, Pete. It better be good, man. I mean, if I see it someday.
I promise it's good.
It's that good. No, that's great. So, I mean, how large is this book? We should let people know, like, how many pages, what should they expect? You were mentioning maybe, what do you call them? When you cross a certain amount of money, like funding sort of like a hardcover possibly. How thick is this thing?
It's pretty big.
It's pretty big. Could you kill a dragon with it?
A baby one.
A goblin?
Definitely. they only got 2d4 plus 2 hit points.
Yeah, I know, right?
You've got... So the story itself is 66 pages of sequential art.
Oh, nice.
Then we have back matter, which consists of some Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition character sheets inspired by the characters in the book.
Smart.
We have a map of the world that all of this takes place in, which follows Martone's path across the lands. We have pinups by some fantastic top-notch artists that we've been able to pull in. We have, and then we've got, you know, the typical stuff, thank you page, all that sort of thing. We did do a charity event with our book for a local cancer charity called Anne's Place here in Connecticut, where we raffled off a cameo in the book.
Oh, nice.
So we were able to raise some money for a good cause there. And so we're going to have a little special call out there. All in all, the book should be at the very least 80 pages. I think it may go over a page or two. We'll see how that goes. But it's definitely 80. And currently it is a soft cover book, which we were gearing up to do on some really good quality thick stock paper with a nice cardstock cover. If we have already hit our funding goal for this.
Yeah.
And we've got about 2 weeks left ish now, a little less. And if we are able to cross the 6,000 mark, which we are under $800 away from hitting, we will be upgrading all physical backers to a hardcover version of the book.
Sweet. That is awesome. Very cool. So you will be able to kill a goblin with it once it's a hardcover book.
Oh, definitely. Maybe two or three.
Especially if you use the corners of the book.
Oh, yeah. Well,
That's great. So, I mean, you're doing a book about a bard. Once you're sort of done with this, are we going to move on to fighter? Are we going to move on to thief? Are we going to do all the other classes? Or are you sticking with the bard for the long term?
We're going to stick with the bard. So to tip our hand a little bit.
You could add a whole Marvel universe of fighter. And
we'll end up bringing more characters in. There are a couple of characters that we brought in that we just like he mentioned Gary before, which is our favorite character. He became kind of our mascot for the book. He'll probably return, but we've definitely been workshopping a volume 2 of this, which will likely have a lot of the same characters and a lot of new characters as well. To really tip my hand, this one will be sort of the same. It'll have the same framing device. It'll be the bard, Martillon, you know, telling his stories or his verses. But they're going to all kind of follow the same theme. So we're going to do like a straight up horror book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we've been talking about that, workshopping some stuff. Pete's been drawing some things that we may or may not be including. So there's definitely been talks about it. Now that we're like funded, you know, it's gonna be much more likely that this would happen. Before, we were kind of like dancing around it, but we for sure want to do another volume, and it would definitely be this if we you know, once the dust settles from this,
sure.
You know, after fulfillment and everybody has their copies and we have copies and whatever happens to the book after that, you know, if we decide to pitch it, hint, hint, you know.
To a publisher, we'll start, you mean?
Yeah.
Then
we'll start production on the next volume.
Oh, that's cool. So the next one will be more... Did you say like horror thing? Like you're thinking like it's going to be like the bard in horror D&D world?
Yeah, it's going to be like, yeah, we want to pay tribute to like more horror creators. So like the first one that I've always wanted to do, like since I've read their work was Junji Ito.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Uzumaki is like one of the scariest books I think I've ever read in my entire life.
Yeah.
So I want to pay tribute to him, of course. Like Walking Dead is like, why wouldn't you?
Sure.
It's still like huge in the cultural zeitgeist, and there are some other ones we've been talking about as well. But those are like the two big ones for sure. But yeah, it'll be along the same line of us telling the story and then. Also paying homage to these creators.
Yeah.
But just again, like this one was like a little bit more lighthearted. The next one will not be as lighthearted. It'll still be fun, but it's going to be a little bit more intense.
So are we going from PG to R? Is that what we're saying?
No, I don't think it's not going to be R rated for sure. Speaking of Bardic Versus has one swear in it. There's little to no blood. I think there's definitely blood, but not a lot. So it's acceptable for like younger readers. But the next one is not going to be like, we're not turning it into like a, like we're not going from like cable TV to like HBO. Yeah.
Well, you said Junji Ito, and I was like, well, "Hey,
yeah,
hey,
it's not
that's crazy
be, like,
time."
Gross. Yeah, it's not going to be gross or gory necessarily, but there'll definitely be some horror elements for sure. And this will all make sense when you read The Bardic Versus Volume 1.
Oh, that's awesome! No, it sounds great. It sounds like a great plan. And I mean, after horror, would you? I mean, if you get to a book three, would there be a different theme again, or?
Maybe again, like this is like, while I have like a very loose outline of where the story is going, I think the beauty of the collaboration between Pete and myself is that like it's fluid and it always has been. Like while I might want to take the story one way, like, we might just in the process of putting it together, we might go somewhere completely different. And I'm totally fine with that. Like I'm not necessarily married to a lot of the book. I think, you know, again, as long as we're telling a coherent story, and hitting all the beats that we need to hit, like, I let Pete kind of do his thing and we kind of just go, and we just spitball and we see what works and what doesn't. And again, like, for this book, we had no timeline for this until like we started reaching the end. And then we're like, all right, we need to like start talking about the Kickstarter seriously and start putting all that stuff together.
Sure.
But we're not in a rush. And we, you know, we do this on our off time.
Of course.
However, like it comes together is fine. Like it doesn't have to be as strict as regular comics.
So
is
interesting. I'm going to sell you something not sell you something, but suggest something, not sell you something. I believe you should go back and look up those 80s RPGs like Gamma World and Star Frontiers and Top Secret. And then you theme the rest of your volumes as the bard in those worlds. Like he falls into other dimensions and there you go. So you've got the post-apocalyptic.
That's not a bad spin.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I think we have bandied about, like, you know, taking Martillon into other realms.
Sure.
But again, I'm trying so hard not to spoil my own book. But
don't spoil it.
Again, the transition from this book to a volume two makes a lot of sense when you read this book.
Sure. Absolutely.
Although having him pop up in somewhere like Shadowrun would be really enticing. Yeah.
There you go. Well, that's the one thing that I learned about Kickstarters and about, you know, making your own like comic projects and stuff. You can do whatever you want. Like, you know, you are not stuck by the world that somebody else has created. You are not, you know, I mean, you're working maybe in Jack Kirby style, but you're not working with his character. So you can do whatever you want and people won't get pissed off at you. Well, I mean, the book sounds great. I can't wait to check it out. Any final words on the Bardic Verses before we sign off?
Back it today. Help us get through that stretch goal.
Close.
And it'll be worth it. We promise. You can follow me on social media, PAC Illustration. That's the three big ones: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Nice. And how about you, Matt?
Yeah. Again, like Pete said, back us on Kickstarter. We have 12 days left. You can find the Kickstarter very easily by either just Googling the Bardic Verses and Kickstarter, or going to TBV, which is the Bardic Verses initials. TBVKickstarter.com will take you right there. And again, for me, like, you could follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, MySpace, Live Journal, Dead Journal, Match.com. at Matt Man Begins is my handle.
No, that is a great Matt Man Begins. I love it. That's fantastic. Well, again, the book is called The Bardic Verses. It is currently on Kickstarter. It has reached its funding goal, but you should throw more gold coins at it, as many gold coins as you can. Again, Kickstarter, go to Kickstarter.com, search The Bardic Verses, throw your gold coins. The two creators I have had on are Matt Sumo and Pete Collins. The book is The Bardic Verses. My name is Christian Horn, and this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. Check out the Bardic Verses. Help support it so that the beholder will not show up in the midnight hour and do whatever the beholder does to you. In any case, we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Part-time fanboy.com.